I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of August. Social Security. We're going to be talking about the future of Social Security as part of a discussion of Voice of the People this hour of the program. It's a really interesting program, a nonpartisan organization that seeks to re-anchor our democracy in its founding principles by giving we the people a greater role in government. Dr. Stephen Kull is founder and president of Voice of the People. He's a political psychologist and director of the Program for Public Consultation at the School of Public Policy, University of Maryland. And for 20 years, he's conducted in-depth studies of public opinion on public policy issues in this country and also around the world. He has worked extensively with officials in the U.S. Congress, the State Department, and the U.N., and we'll be welcoming phone calls. We heard about this Voice of the People when we were having a discussion about the Iran deal a few weeks ago. And there was a Voice of the People done on the Iran deal. They're also doing one now on the U.S. Post Office. And we thought we would start, because we talked a little bit about Iran. We'll get into that later this hour. But we thought we would start with Social Security. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we speak with Professor Kull. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd like to get messages from you there. And we're on Twitter as well. And that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Stephen Kull, thank you very much for being with us. I love this project. I think it should be front and center in every political discussion, and Congress ought to be reading your results extensively. It's really a good idea. And it's not just an idea. It's been around for a while.
Well, a lot of Americans agree with you. A lot of Americans feel that the American people should have a greater voice in government, and they believe that if the people had a greater voice, then there probably would be less polarization and gridlock in Congress, and there is a lot of evidence to say that they're actually right.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit during a previous show about the Iran deal, so let's start with Social Security. Tell me how you lined up people from a very red and then a very blue district and got them to examine the future of Social Security.
Well, we recruited representative samples in three states, one a very red state, which was Oklahoma, one a very blue state, which is Maryland, and then also a purple state, Virginia. And then within Maryland and Oklahoma, we also recruited a sample from a very particularly red district and a particularly blue district in Maryland. And these people are recruited just like you would for any poll or survey. It's called stratified random sampling. Everybody has an equal chance of being recruited. However, they do need to be registered voters. That's the only requirement. And so you end up with something that's pretty much a mirror of the general population, or I should say, of the electorate. We make sure that if there's any variation in a particular survey, we weight it according to the statistics that are available, to really make sure it's a good mirror.
And then these people who participate get very fully informed from a wide variety of perspectives as to what the issue is.
Yeah, we take them through a process we call a policy-making simulation. Now, we don't just say, do you favor or oppose this? Because the research we have shows that people have a lot of, there are a lot of things they don't know, or they might even have a lot of misinformation, a lot of incorrect ideas. And we also want to make sure that they've heard all of the arguments, the real key arguments, pro and con, on the issues. So we take them through this process called a policy-making simulation that tries to put them in the shoes of a policymaker. So they're given a briefing on the issue. We try to do it in an engaging way with some visuals and graphs and things like that. And then we present the policy options. And then for each policy option, they're presented arguments for and against each option. And the briefing and the arguments and all the materials are vetted with congressional staffers from both parties, as well as outside groups, so that you can be really confident that what you're getting here is a really good mirror of the complete picture of what's going on in the in Congress.
So do members of Congress see the results?
Yes, we brief them on the findings from their state or district, and also of the nation as a whole and other states and districts and so on. Before we recruit for their particular state or district, we meet with them and want to make sure that they're interested and they're involved and engaged. And overall, we've found a lot of interest throughout Congress. We've met with quite a few members of Congress, and there's really nothing but a positive view of this process. They think they want to know what their constituents
sure.
think.
Yeah. A major reason you write in the overview to the Social Security project that you did, a major reason that Social Security has not been addressed is a widespread assumption that the American public is not willing or able to face the issue, and thus bringing it up is too politically risky. I believe you found that to not be true.
Well, if you look at standard polls, you might get that impression because people will say, "Yeah, there's something needs to be done about Social Security," and then, but in a separate question, you say, "Well, do you want to raise the retirement age?" And people go, "Well, no, not really. I think I'd like to lower it down to whatever age I am." So it's of course people want to raise the retirement age. Do you want to raise the payroll tax? Well, not really. Do you want to cut benefits? Well, no, not really. And so when you put those poll results together, you think, well, the public's just a big baby. They're incoherent, you know. But the problem is in each case you've asked them what you want in isolation. They aren't really in a problem-solving mode. So what we do is we put them in a problem-solving mode. We say, here's the problem. Here's how it works. And here are the options. We don't tell them you have to solve the problem, but they understand how it works. And so in the end, all of the options for dealing with Social Security are presented to them, and in the end, it's all put together in one big long list, and a little bubble tells them how much of the, when they make decisions, it tells them how much of the Social Security shortfall they've covered, and then they go along and they make their decisions, and they get that feedback. And in that context, they do really well. In fact, overall, two-thirds, three-quarters of Republicans and Democrats agreed on steps that eliminated most of the Social Security shortfall. So, not only did they solve it, they found common ground, unlike what tends to happen in Congress. When they see the problem, they understand it, they act in a way that makes a lot of sense.
Hmm. Well, maybe members of Congress need to be made to attend one of these citizen cabinet initiatives when they're dealing with big policy issues, because they sure don't seem to be able to find common ground.
Yeah, I have to say some of the congressional staffers I've talked to when I've shown them the process that people go through, the policy-making simulation. So when they go, gee, I wish I could get my boss to do it.
Right, right, I'm sure. Yeah. And to look at the issue with Social Security, according to the trustees report, you say if no steps are taken by Congress to reform, the trust fund will be exhausted by 2033. That's not too long from now.
Yeah, and that means that it doesn't mean that Social Security would just disappear.
Right.
But it does mean that they would have to start cutting benefits, and they'd have to cut them by almost a quarter. So that would be a rather drastic cut, and a lot of people really rely on their Social Security benefits. So that would be very a real crisis for a significant number of people. And so we explain to them that here's this thing coming, and if we don't do something about it, that's going to hit, and maybe that's okay with you, and that it does, but maybe it's not. For most people, it's not, and so here are the steps that can be taken.
And it is a very popular program, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, very popular. Americans just basically think it's a good idea, and it's very bipartisan, a very large majority have a positive view of Social Security.
So what did those Republicans and Democrats, what common ground did they find?
Well, there were some options that are not as You know, there's been a lot of talk about changing the way that you adjust cost of living, adjustments, COLAs, that have gotten a lot of attention. That those ideas were not very popular, but what did get high levels of consensus was to reduce benefits for the upper 25% of earners.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, about more than three quarters thought this was a good idea. And again, this is it's very very bipartisan. You know, more than three quarters of both Republicans and Democrats thought this was a good idea. Reducing the benefits for the top 40% that didn't get some such high levels of support. That did not get a majority. Raising the retirement age to 68 gets about 8 in 10 in support. Raising the cap on taxable earnings. Now, see, so the first, it's only about the first 117,000, I think is the most recent number, of income is subject to the payroll tax. And it's possible to raise the cap on the amount of income subject to that tax. And more than 80% overall thought that was a good idea, to raise it to at least $215,000. And a majority even favored eliminating entirely, but that was a more modest majority.
Mm-hmm.
The other idea was to raise the payroll tax rate. Right now it's at 6.2% for both the employee and the employer. And they would raise it to, from 6.2 to 6.6%.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea, Dr. Cole, why it is that Congress didn't look at, maybe we weren't making that much money in those days, why they put a cap on taxable income?
Well, that was part of the original concept, that this was a wasn't simply a tax like an income tax, that you're personally setting aside money for your account with your Social Security account. Now, it always had some progressivity, or had progressive effects, in the sense that the wealthier didn't get back as much relative to what they put in as the less wealthy. But if you eliminated the cap entirely, that would skew it further, that the wealthy would be even getting less back as a percentage of what they put in.
Mm-hmm. So was it a long process to come to agreement on what needs to be done here? Was there a lot of debate back and forth, and it took a long time to reach consensus?
Well, let me clarify. This is actually done. People do this individually online. They go through this process independently, and then we can look at the differences between what people say in the comma and grant. Now, we also at times get people together in groups and have them discuss it and so on. That's always exciting, because people, you know, find this common ground, and then they get to see how representative samples across the country have done with it as well. But yes, it's an individually done, and anybody can do it too. By the way, any of your listeners out there can go online, go to VOP.org, and you can go through this Social Security simulation yourself. And at the end, you can summarize your conclusions and send them off to your members of Congress and tell them what you think.
So we're
trying to promote everybody being involved in this process, not just the, you know, scientifically selected citizen cabinet. And members of Congress, they want to know sort of what the general distribution is, but they also particularly want to know what the views of people who are really engaged enough to make the effort.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Dr. Cull. Dr. Stephen Cull is our guest this hour. He's the founder and president of Voice of the People. He's a political psychologist and director of the Program for Public Consultation, the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. This is such a valuable, valuable program for all of us who live in this democracy. It seeks to give we the people a greater role in government. People who participate are very well versed in what an issue is, and they've looked at a lot of issues. Post offices, what they're they're looking at now. They recently did Social Security. They did the Iran deal very recently. And you're informed on what the issue is by people from a lot of different viewpoints. In the case of Social Security, what it would take to keep Social Security going, which we face now by 2033, a reduction in benefits if there aren't changes to the program. So what changes would be amenable to most people, to Republicans and Democrats? And they found agreement on what Dr. Cole just outlined. And you can do this yourself, which is great. So if you go to VOP.org, you can take the whole survey and essentially take a course on reforming Social Security or on Iran or the post office or many other issues, and then let your voice be heard by your member of Congress. Here's our phone number where we would like to have your voice be heard on this issue. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Cole has worked with members of Congress, the State Department, the UN, testified before Congress, conducted briefings for NATO, the UN, the European Commission, and he writes for many publications and is on broadcast media as well. So we'll go to you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Dr. Hull. Dr. Cole, our phone number is 800-486-8655. And Ruth in Eau Claire is our first caller for you, Dr. Cole. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. And I'm real excited about this program. I just think it's great and a awesome way to actualize democracy. In terms of the Social Security issue, I know some people very close to the Social Security Administration and who understand have been telling me that the plan for Social Security Administration is to close many of the local offices over time, which would sort of expect people to manage Social Security changes and access to the benefits online, and that there will only be a very small handful of these offices where you can meet somebody in person. And I know from my own personal experience that meeting with these really knowledgeable people locally and not having to travel long distances in order to do it is really important. And when I talk to people about it, no matter what their political bent, they really want those offices locally. Is that an issue addressed in your survey?
Oh, we didn't address that specifically, but it's kind of inherent in the whole underfunding of Social Security. And the question was, do people see that it's important enough to give Social Security what's needed to do what it's charged to do, which is centrally giving those benefits, but also the whole mechanism for delivering them to people as they deserve them and are and have the right to get them. So I think that's implicit in the concerns about the kinds of things you're raising is implicit in their strong affirmation of the need to give the Social Security Administration what it needs to do its job.
Right.
And Ruth, if you don't mind, you seem to be well-versed on the topic. When you think about reforms that will keep Social Security going and strong for a long time, do you agree with what the consensus was among Republicans and Democrats in the Voice of the People?
Yeah, I really do. And I think, we've been sold kind of a bill of goods overall because the solutions are really not that difficult. I really believe that. And with the kinds of things that you're explaining on the air in terms of what could help fix it. And it seems to me that there was also a holiday not too long ago to how much people paid in. And that I just have no idea where that's why we did that. But.
Mm-hmm. But I think overall what you're seeing is that basically Congress is in this polarized mode where they've made commitments to certain positions that are related to campaign donors. So we have these pledges, never raise taxes or never raise the retirement age or never reduce benefits. And when you have members of Congress that come to the table who have made these kinds of commitments related, again, to those campaign donations, then it's really hard to to find any common ground, because everybody has already committed to being, you know, intransigent from their positions. But when you give the public, you know, the tools, they go, okay, well, here's what's needed, and here are the options. And what they tend to do is try to distribute the pain in a more even way and not have any particular population take too much of the brunt of it. And then they come up with a plan. Right now, the Congress is essentially stuck in needing something to come in from the outside and help break this up. And when we talk to people on the Hill, they share this feeling. They're very frustrated that they can't solve problems like Social Security.
Thank you very much, Ruth, for the call. You think about, and it's worth just thinking for a moment and studying the history of Social Security, you think about what a huge idea this was. 35, is that when it started, 1935? What a completely dramatic thing for Congress to enact, and it saves so many people from deep poverty when they're old.
That's right. And that's why it's very popular among the American people. They like knowing that it's there as a kind of ultimate safety net when they're
right
in their old age.
Well, they got it passed back in 35. It's really amazing that people can't fix it in 2015, that it's too politically risky. It must have been really politically risky back in 35, wasn't it?
It was definitely a challenge. There was a lot of controversy then. There's less controversy now.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is really saying just get rid of it. That's just not
right.
Possible anymore.
Ruth, thanks so much for your call. Lori in Viroqua. Hi.
Hi. I probably don't have any solutions for redistributing it right now, but I'm always curious in these conversations. We rarely talk about that wages went stagnant, in mid-early 80s, and they haven't really risen, especially when you compare it to the growth of the economy, and the wealthy people did get very wealthy in the last 40 years, and working people really didn't share from that. So how much of the deficit now or whatever is due to the fact that wages never kept up with the pace of the economy, and certainly not with pace of, you know, what wealthy people were making? So anyway, that's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, stagnant wages certainly contributed to less revenue, and less revenue contributed to the shortfall problem. As for the redistribution in the sense of the wages going up for the wealthy, you see a pretty strong concern about that expressed in a variety of surveys that we've done, and in this case you see a readiness to raise the cap on taxable earnings dramatically to up to $215,000, and you even have a majority calling to eliminate it entirely, so that all income would be subject to the payroll tax. And nationally, even 53% of Republicans favored that idea of eliminating the cap. So this speaks to some concern on the part of the American public about this, the fact that there has been this increasing gap in incomes between the middle class and wealthy.
And of all the things that you could do to ensure the healthy future of Social Security, would raising that cap be the most important, Dr. Cole?
It would have the biggest impact, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of the amount of dollars that it would create to address the problem, it has the biggest impact. Just, eliminating the cap alone would take care of almost two-thirds of it.
Mm. Our number is 800-486-8655 to hear your thoughts, and we'd love to hear the voice of the people on this show. Ellen writes on Facebook, I would love to be a citizen cabinet member, but I say let's make our elected officials do their job, not do it for them.
Well, you know, the idea of going back to the founders was not that, you know, people go vote and elect their officials and then that's it. The founders said that members of Congress should be constantly interacting with their constituents and getting their input. And there was always a concern by the founders that there was going to be this tendency to fall into factions, and that and they too, they worried about campaign donations playing a role and then creating a kind of bias and preventing members from really thinking about the common good. And they thought that if members continued to pay attention to their constituents, they would be more likely to pursue policies that serve the common good. So this the concept that we are really pursuing here, we see as completely consistent with the idea of democracy that goes back to the founders, that involves an engaged electorate, tracking the policies and giving their recommendations to their members.
Hmm. Do you have any idea, Dr. Cole, how engaged the electorate is?
Well, they're very frustrated these days. And over the last few decades, in the 60s, large majorities has expressed confidence that the government would do the right thing, and that's just been on this downward slide. And there's a strong perception that special interests dominate, and that it's just a struggle between big interests rather than trying to serve the common good, and that turns people off. They disengage, and they think that members don't listen to the people, and so they say, why bother? And we run up against this when we try to recruit people to participate in the citizen cabinets. A lot of people say, what's the point? Now, in fact, they are interested. They do want to know. Yes, they do get contributions from special interests, and those special interests lean on them. But when we talk to the congressional staffers, they say, wow, this would be really useful to us, because if it's really clear what the people are saying, that makes it easier for us to stand up to special interests, because we can say, look, here it is, expect. So that gives them more room, more political room, and they like that. They don't like being pushed around by special interests.
Let's go next to Doug in Oshkosh. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm all right. My question is a little bit off topic from what I've been hearing on the radio. I'm wondering if this is the wrong time to ask about marijuana reform on the federal level.
Will you be looking at that issue for Voice of the People?
It's the kind of thing we could look at. We don't have it on our agenda right now, we want to do a project related to drug policy broadly, and that is one of those interesting situations where attitudes in a lot of states have been shifting, and the federal government has been resisting it to some extent, but not as much as they could have. So we're definitely in one of those curious periods where attitudes have really shifted significantly, and the government isn't always adjusting to those changes.
Right. And not given very much credit for doing their jobs either. They're not held in very high esteem these days, people in government.
Yeah, I mean, views of Congress are just very, very low. And when you see the amount of money pouring into these presidential campaigns, it only contributes to that sense.
Right. Thank you, Doug, for the call. Which brings to mind how you decide. We made mention when we were talking about the Iran deal. We made mention of the citizen surveys, citizen cabinet surveys, a few weeks ago, and I thought that was a very valuable survey that you had done on an issue that can be quite complicated. How do you decide what it is you're going to pay attention to?
Well, we look at the speeches on the floor of Congress. That's one of the first places where we start. Again, what we're trying to do is recreate the experience that a member of Congress has when they're thinking about what to do. So we try to give them you know, a little summaries of the speeches that are being made in Congress from both sides of the aisle or both sides of the issue. And then we go around, we talk to experts, and we ask staffers, and we say, you know, well, what are the strongest issues being made, particularly by people who hold the position strongly, and then we keep working until they're satisfied. Yes, that's the key argument we're making. And it's only then that we then give it to the citizen cabinet. So it's not really that we decide as much as the advocates decide
mm-hmm.
what's the most important thing to be heard or what are the argument to be made.
Tom in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi, how are you doing, Kathleen?
Fine, Tom. How are you?
Great show, and I listened to the one in Iran, too, and it was fantastic.
Thank you.
What I wanted to say, though, is that, you know, for me and for people listening to you, this is great stuff, but the problem is the mainstream media is simply non-existent when it comes to really informing people anymore about what's going on in the world. And so the real question is, how do we get this, I don't know what to call it, this basement of ignorance that exists now and wherein most decisions seem to be made with people shouting back and forth at each other. How do we raise that to the first floor in the media so that we actually get discussion of these kinds of findings and thoughtfulness out there to the public? Right now, it's not happening.
Good question, Dr. Cole.
Well, there's a lot of information out in the media. It's often not organized in a form that people can really assimilate it well. Some of it is just gets very bound up in the kind of political posturing, the partisan fighting, and so on. And so that they're not really getting at the substantial issues underneath, the underlying value questions that behind the different positions. So our whole goal is to bring to the surface the value considerations that are behind each position. Now, and what we find is that people tend to find the arguments on both sides at least somewhat convincing. It's normal for majorities to find arguments on both sides. People are, when they hear, you know, when they encounter Congress and what's reported in the media, it's just like there's a strong set of advocates on one side and a strong set of advocates on the other, and it's all about the fight. For the average person, that doesn't make sense. For the average person, they see some validity on both sides. That's like they're saying, oh, yeah, that's a good point. Oh, yeah, that's a good point, too. And then they try to go, well, what's the right balance? Or is there some way, you know, we can bring this together and, you know, have the right combination of, you know. They try to integrate values rather than choosing between them. And that's why they're kind of turned off by the way that the media portrays the issue as just this, you know, this fight. And when they're given when they understand what the underlying value issues and they understand the options, then they come to closure. They do make decisions, difficult decisions that require trade-offs. And then there's a kind of wisdom to it, and the people feel a kind of disconnect between that kind of process and what the media is reporting.
You see these voices of the people every so often, and it's usually during presidential years when the major networks will gather some 10 people from some town in Virginia or wherever they happen to be and ask what their thoughts are about issues. Wouldn't it be nice if it were really a regularly scheduled part of cable or network news or wherever you would find it, so that your model or maybe even you could come on the air once you've done one of these studies and explain to people what the results are? It would encourage civil discourse, and it would certainly encourage becoming informed on what the issues are.
Yeah, well, that's maybe what we're doing right here today.
Absolutely.
Right. And I think the idea of bringing small groups of representative samples to respond to things, I think that's great. You know, you just get, you know, how often do you, when you see those things, you go, wow, they're kind of reasonable. What happened to that? Why can't that kind of, you know, fair, balanced reasonableness play a bigger role in how we do things?
Well, how do you answer that? Why can't it?
Well, I think it can. It just, right now, and that was really the original idea of what Congress was supposed to be, is a set of representative people. And, the original idea was that they would spend only a few months a year, and Washington would spend most of the time at home, and each member of the House only represented about 20,000 people, which is like a little village,
Right.
They could get a good sense of that, but now that's just been so lost because they represent much, much larger numbers of people, and the amount of money that pours into the campaign process.
I know, right.
All special interests. So there's a disconnect that's happened. So we have to find a new way, a new means to bring back that kind of common sense sensibility of the American people, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Gary in Iron River sends this email. It strikes me as not surprising that a majority of people will support taking benefits away from someone else when it comes to the decrease of benefits to the top 25%, particularly when the decisions happen in isolation and they don't have to look representatives of that 25% in the face or hear their arguments of why it may not be fair.
I'm really glad you brought up that question, because that's a very good question and one that we studied. So we wondered, well, the people who are the people who are in the top 25% who would be affected by this decrease in the benefits of the top 25%, are they less supportive than people who wouldn't be affected by it? Or, and the same applies to raising the cap on income subject to payroll tax. People with incomes over $100,000 would be affected by that, while people with incomes less than $100,000 wouldn't be. So you would think that the people above $100,000 or in the top 25% would resist these ideas, and people below would be in support of it. That's not what happens. There's actually no difference.
Hmm.
They're basically the same. And what happens is that people, when they think about these issues, they don't simply say, well, what's in it for me? They really do try to answer the question, what serves the common good? And that's what the founders thought would happen, and there's evidence, a lot of evidence. And we're not the only ones who have found this to be the case. There's quite a lot of research showing that if you just ask people to think about what should be done, that's what they think about. They don't, and then only afterwards they go, well, yeah, and I need to think some about myself too. But basically, when they answer a policy question, they make the recommendations. They're not primarily thinking of themselves.
Thank you, Tom, for your call. Joanne Sturgeon Bay. Hello.
Hello. Thank you, and once again, a wonderful program, Kathleen.
Thanks.
And I'm not sure if my question applies to this excellent reporting, but I wondered how you would clarify. I'm in my 80s, so I'm all set with whatever is happening. But I have two adult children in their 60s, and we've had some discussions about when it's best to take your benefits. And I wondered if you could clarify how you would evaluate that.
Well, that's an individual decision, whether you take early retirement or wait longer. On the average, I understand that it's better to wait longer, but some people just have more immediate needs. And all of the changes that are being discussed don't change that flexibility. Even if we talk about raising the retirement age, that's the standard retirement age. You still have the option of taking earlier retirement, but your benefits would of course be lower. That's a very individual question to be considered.
How often do you do these citizen cabinet surveys?
Well, we're gearing up, and over the next few months, we expect to have them coming out every 4 to 6 weeks.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, as mentioned, we did one on the deal with Iran, we're going to very shortly have one late in September come out on what to do about the Postal Service. And then after that, we're going to do one on the federal budget. And that's very interesting. We're going to give people the discretionary budget, here's how it's presently all distributed, and here are the sources of all the revenues with the tax rates and all that. And up here on the top is a bubble showing you what the deficit is, and then you can make up your own budget, and you raise and lower spending in all the areas, and the little bubble tells you how that affects the deficit, and you can change tax rates, and you can increase certain kinds of taxes. It's really a lot of fun because you really have the sense of, wow, I'm really in control here. And what people say is, you know, like, oh, I really reduced the deficit, and it wasn't that hard. And in fact, when we did this a few years ago, on average, people cut the deficit over $400 billion. See, I mean, in standard poll, people say, you know, do you want to cut the deficit? Yeah. Do you want to raise taxes? Well, no. And do you want to cut spending? Well, no. But here's another example. We give them the right tools, and they do deal with the issue, and they can really express their values. And there are a lot of surprises for them. For example, people have this idea, oh, if you just cut foreign aid, it would make this great big difference. You know, going back to the point about people not having always having the right information, we once asked people, how much of the budget do you think goes to foreign aid? And the median estimate was 20% of the budget.
Whoa.
In fact, it was just 1% of the budget.
Yes.
They get to see that, and people are often surprised how much goes to defense, for example. In the last time we did it, in fact, people increased humanitarian spending some, and they reduced defense spending significantly. So there are often real surprises when they finally get that information. But we're also going to look at Medicare, poverty programs, energy policy, climate change, things like that.
Yeah. Do you do this program in schools, Dr. Cole?
We do have connections with a number of universities, and we're encouraging them to use the policymaking simulations in classes, and some of them and people are starting to do that. We're not in full gear yet, our ultimate goal is to have a citizen cabinet in every district and state in the country, so that every member of Congress can know what their constituents think. And you can read all about the plan on the website, VOP.org. You know, that's where you can go and do the policy-making simulations. But you can also hear about our plan. And you can also sign the petition to create this national citizen cabinet that would have every member of Congress with their citizen cabinet. And so our goal is to create a national academy for public consultation that would be congressionally chartered and be supported by Congress, so that because to do this for the whole country, we'd have to have over 100,000 people participating in each of these surveys, that's a real challenge in terms of covering those costs. So we would need some help from Congress to make that happen. But when we've asked people about it in surveys, they think it's a great idea.
Yes.
And if any of your readers think so, it would be great to sign the petition and make your voice heard on that.
Yeah, it's a truly, truly great idea. We're talking about the latest citizen cabinet survey from the Voice of the People, which is a wonderful nonpartisan organization that wants to give American people a more effective voice in the policymaking process. So they do this very, very elaborate process. It's online, and they get representative samples of certain parts of the country that are, you know, combination of red and blue and purple, and take on, inform these people about all sides of an issue, be it the Iran deal. The latest one that we're talking about today in more detail is the future of Social Security. They're looking at the post office. We'll have to have Dr. Cull on when that one is released. We should have him on when they're all released, because they're fascinating. And it turns out that people really are proud to be and happy to be members of a democracy and learn about the issues and thoughtfully decide what course of action should be taken. So it's a way for members of Congress to listen to the people as well. If you want to take one of these surveys, or if you would like to follow through with what Dr. Cull said and make sure that this is a national program, go to VOP.org and wiggle around and see what you find. It's good. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Dr. Stephen Cull is founder and president of Voice of the People. He's a political psychologist and director of the program for public consultation in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. And for two decades now, he has conducted in-depth studies of public opinion on public policy issues in this country and all around the world. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Dr. Stephen Cull. Jerry in Stockbridge is next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Great show today. Great guest. I would like to bring up a point about raising the retirement age, say, to 68. And while through mainly medical means, people tend to be living longer, so they're drawing benefits longer, the idea of extending this minimum age to collect benefits just so often is just overlooked or failed to recognize that there's physical limitations. So many people, working class, welders, machinists, bricklayers, carpenters, they simply cannot continue. They're not physically able to work to 68. And for that matter, a lot of their employers simply don't want them working at 68.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much this has been taken into consideration with the doctor's program here that he's discussing, or we're discussing, I should say.
Yeah, we're.
But I'll take my answer
off.
All
right, Jerry. No, it's a good,
yeah,
it's a good point.
A very good case, and the argument you just made is one that is that's included in the simulation and survey that people went through. Almost you said it very articulately, and that idea was put forward, and it's a majority did raise it to 68. A majority did not want to raise it to 69. So it's not that there was no consideration about it for these kinds of things. And it is, of course, important to remember that the plan that's in being considered does not preclude taking early retirement. It's just that the standard retirement age was raised.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Jerry. Email from a listener wondering if the citizen cabinet surveys will examine the Citizens United decision and if there is support for a constitutional amendment.
We do have that on our list to look at campaign finance reform, one of the issues would be the potential for a constitutional amendment.
David, we have about 30 seconds left. Dave, hi, go ahead.
Hi. I know that conclusions can be influenced by how the questions are asked, which you've already gone into some. And I'm wondering who is vetting your organization or your methodology.
Okay, we can go with that.
Well, we have a bipartisan oversight board, but more importantly, everything that people go through is vetted with congressional staffers from both parties who are the congressional experts on the issue. We also talk with outside groups, conservative, liberal, so that like with this one, National Academy for Social Insurance, a liberal group, American Enterprise Institute, conservative group. So everything is vetted across the spectrum. And the key thing is that you really, when people hear all sides of the issue, then the effect of wording tends to diminish. So they need the time to deliberate so that what you get in the end is something that really is reflective of their values.
Dr. Cull, thank you. Join us again. VOP.org is the place to go, right?
That's right.
All right. Thanks. He'll be with us every time one of these comes out. I reckon that'd be a good idea. Thanks to KP Whaley and to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting hour.